Okay, good morning, everyone. My name is Glenn Howard. I'm president of the Jamestown Foundation. Just wanted to thank you for coming to our conference today on Yemen. It's called The War Without End. We have a great lineup for you to speak today. As many of you may know, March 26 marked the end of the fourth year of the Saudi-led war in Yemen. 4 years of devastating aerial bombing and tens of billions of dollars have borne few, if any, results other than the devastation to the people of Yemen. The Houthis right now retain control of the northwest, and most of Yemen has devolved into warring fiefdoms controlled by an ever-growing number of armed factions. The presence of outside powers and the money and arms they supply are fueling interlocking conflicts in Yemen. Increasingly, the countries of the Arabian Peninsula and other neighboring powers, with the exception of neighboring Oman, are in competition with one another in Yemen as the two countries support both Saudi Arabia and the UAE support factions that oppose one another inside of Yemen. The involvement of the outside powers and the money and weapons that they continue to provide to those forces are fueling factionalism and continued conflict. As is shown by the recent battles for Hodeidah, there is no military solution to the war in Yemen. The Stockholm Agreement, while limited in its scope, points to the only way forward for Yemen, gradual de-escalation that will produce pockets of relative stability. Over the long term, the conflict in Yemen will only abate once outside powers pull back and suspend their lavish funding for an ever-growing number of factions. And also from the Jamestown perspective, lest we forget the counterterrorism dimension, that Islamic State and Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula are still very active in Yemen, including the fact that Abu Abbas who is on the U.S. terrorism most wanted list, controls the city of Taiz. So this being said, with the roles of ACAP and Islamic State, the conflict in Yemen continues. It remains active and is not going away, as there are many different interested parties participating in fueling the conflict. Only with the cessation of outside support will more than disrupt the interlocking nature of Yemen's conflicts. So on that note, I'd like to thank everyone for coming. We have a great setup, a lineup of speakers today, and moderating the panel. The first panel will be former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, Edmund Hull. But before we begin, I'd very much like to thank a special friend of the Jamestown Foundation, Louise Oliver, for her generous support in helping us to bring the people together today for this event to discuss the tragedy that is ongoing in Yemen. So, Ambassador Hull, the floor is yours.
Is this live? Can everyone hear? Okay, I've seen these kind of meetings before entitled The Forgotten War in Yemen. And one of the very few hopeful aspects of the situation is that clearly the war in Yemen is no longer forgotten. It's very much on people's minds. I picked up the Washington Post this morning, turned to the editorial page, and was treated to the Post's analysis of recent legislation and back and forth between Congress and the President. So I see that as a positive note. And also, Glenn, underlining the timeliness of our getting together today to reassess the situation as political forces here in Washington and elsewhere begin and engage in the conflict there. Glenn has entitled our panel, Yemen at a Crossroads. I do think that's overly optimistic. It kind of conjures up a nice crossing of two paved roadways. My personal experience in Yemen is that we are more in a wadi in the desert with various diverging tracks going who knows where. And in that kind of situation, you want to have good local knowledge, good local guides to help you develop a picture of where you are so that you can think about where you want to go. And it is fortunate that we have on our panel this morning those kinds of guides who can help us establish a common operating picture of what is happening in Yemen as a basis for further consideration of what needs to be done, where we need to go. We have with us on this panel Dr. Nabil Khoury, who I was pleased to serve with in Yemen in the 2000s. Nabil had a long career in the State Department after Yemen, in Iraq, and then in academia in Chicago. And Nabil has recently written a book about his experience in the State Department entitled No Regrets, which we are very much looking forward to its publication. I wish I could say no regrets after a long time in the State Department. We also have with us Sama Al-Hamdani, who is going to look at the various dimensions of the conflict. She's currently at Georgetown, but has provided knowledge and experience to a number of prominent think tanks in Washington, Carnegie, Brookings, the Institute for Peace. And then finally, we have with us Basma Alush from the Norwegian Refugee Council, who brings with her great insight into the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is of great and pressing importance. So I will start by introducing Nabil and ask him to give us an overview of the situation on the ground, and particularly the kind of forces which are in play, changing, evolving, and shaping the problem that we have. Nabil?
Thank you, Edmund. By the way, no regrets doesn't mean that I didn't see some very bad things happening on the ground over the 25 years that I was in the Foreign Service. It just means that, you know, I came, I saw, I did my best, and at least I was there for some of the bad stuff and lived to tell about it. So hopefully my book should be out in a couple of months from Westphalia Press. No Regrets, an Arab American in the U.S. Foreign Service. It is both sort of a personal view and also a perspective on U.S. policy in the Middle East over that span of years, and how it changed and how the perception of it changed in the region. Onto Yemen, I wanted to talk about U.S. policy and then broaden it and get into some of the dynamics that Edmund was talking about. And then I'm sure that Sama, who is going to talk about the internal dynamics in Yemen, will fill the gaps that I'm certain to leave on the internal situation. In Yemen. Crossroads is not necessarily an optimistic thing. I mean, you're always told from when you're young, you know, you reach a crossroad, you look both ways. And if you don't look both ways, you're likely to be run over by something. It may well be that we're at a crossroads in Yemen, but not necessarily in the positive sense. My overall assessment is that we're not likely to see anything really positive in the next 2 years. I think, in fact, things may get worse before they get better. This is a small, cozy group, so you know we'll keep things in an outline format, and then we can get into a good discussion in depth after our presentations are finished. Let me just start by saying very succinctly and very bluntly, the war in Yemen is in its fifth year, and it has accomplished nothing for the Arab coalition and by proxy for the United States national interest. If the stated goals are to be believed, rolling back the Houthi coup of 2014 has not been accomplished. They're still ensconced in Sana'a. Restoring what is called Sharia, the legitimacy or the Hadi government, to Sana'a, obviously, has not happened. They're mostly happily living in Riyadh with occasional visits to Yemen. But they have not managed to establish themselves even in liberated Aden or in Sayoun, where they recently had a parliamentary revival of sorts. All right, keeping Iran out of Yemen, which was touted as the Saudi, the Arab coalition goal, and something that tickled the fancy of the Trump administration. That has backfired, even stating it as a goal, because Iran was not there at the beginning. It is there now, if indirectly. To the extent that, certainly when Edmund and I were there, and then up to 2009, there was hardly any Iranian influence in Yemen, let alone an actual presence. They started helping the Houthis slightly in 2010 and then more in 2015. And now there is, by proxy, Iranian influence through the assistance that Hezbollah lends to the Houthis in technical expertise and strategic advice and so on. So if the goal of this war was to roll back Iran, it achieved the opposite. So that, too, has been a failure. As for terrorism, keeping Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, out of Yemen, by all accounts, AQAP is stronger now than it ever was in Yemen. And the war against it is complicated by the fact that it is quite often allied on the ground with forces that are working for the Arab coalition, which complicates the task if the U.S. is truly trying to make advances against AQAP on the ground. It complicates it that their allies are, whether directly or indirectly, working with them. For the Houthis, of course, they certainly, whatever ambitions they had at the beginning of this, they no longer have. Their main ambition at this point is to hold on to what they have. And on that front, they're still where they were 4 years ago, mostly. If this war had been run by a private sector company, that company would have gone out of business. Bringing all the latest technology to bear on the conflict, and you fail to accomplish any of your basic goals, why are you still in business? But of course, we're not going to blame this war on Donald Trump, but he's a master at failing in business and yet somehow keeping his business afloat. So the war goes on, but frankly, from any rational point of view, it doesn't make any sense. The main problem, in my opinion, is that there has not been a clear strategic view and a well-thought-out strategy. One of the fun things I did in the Foreign Service was I taught at the Marine War College for a year, And then towards the end of my career, I taught for a year at the National Defense University. And other than the fact that the military are always open-minded and willing to really entertain all ideas, they really focus on strategy, that you have to properly define your goal at the beginning and make sure that that goal is in line with your national interest, that you look at the means you have to achieve these goals and that they're all lined up. And then you establish steps. How do I get from here to there? And then you establish criteria that measure your success or your failure, so that if you don't achieve success, you know it, and you stop or you turn around and do something different. This is what the Obama administration perhaps started to do in defining the goals of the U.S. In Yemen, among them very laudable goals of supporting a democratic transition, supporting good governance, economic assistance for development projects in cooperation with other donor countries, and at the end, counterterrorism. This strategy was, I mean, it's nice to have all these things on paper, but in reality, it was sort of upended. The counterterrorism thing took prominence, became the one that is the goal that was most funded. In fact, Obama turned, used Yemen as an example of an ideal approach to counterterrorism, that this is where U.S. policy was succeeding. And he's the one who's best known for the drone war on Yemen. Bush, before him, hardly resorted to drones. But President Obama didn't want to use troops. And so he was happy to play the technology game, which in my view, and I wrote at the time, drones do not a policy make. And in fact, they created more problems and more enemies for the U.S. than accomplished a defeat of AQAP. The other things that upended Obama's strategy were the happenings on the ground, the Arab uprising, the Yemeni uprising in this case, turned the tables around. And Ali Abdullah Saleh, who along with his security establishment were allies in the war on terrorism, left. His departure was arranged by the GCC at the time. And for a while, there was some confusion. The advice from high circles in Washington was to continue working with the security establishment of Saleh, even if he himself was out of the picture, which made things awkward in dealing with his successor, Hadi. It made Hadi's job more difficult. And the Obama strategy was also upended by the Saudi / GCC request for assistance. Essentially, Obama bought Saudi acquiescence in the Iran nuclear deal by agreeing to help them with the war when they started it in 2015. And that made things very difficult. The war at that point became the Arab coalition's war, essentially Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And American goals, no matter how loftily defined, were no longer possible to pursue. The in comes Trump. I think the President Obama himself and John Kerry had some buyer's remorse towards the end of their term, and John Kerry went to Oman and tried to a last-ditch effort to at diplomacy, which we had neglected in the last few years of the Obama administration. And in 48 hours were certainly not enough to pursue the goal of peace. And there was some attempt at holding back on some of the weapons supplied to Saudi Arabia, specifically the precision-guided missiles. But this was all too little too late. In comes Donald Trump, and the most generous thing one can say about this administration and Yemen is that they really don't care about Yemen. They don't care what happens to Yemen. And honestly, I mean, I'm not being unfair to them, but this is obvious in every action they take, in every statement they make. The main concern has been commercial dealings, and some of them very personal for Mr. Trump, and also essentially giving in completely to the Saudi and Emirati perspective on what's happening in Yemen. Essentially saying to them, what happens inside Yemen is your problem, this is your neighbor, you take care of it. You tell me what you need, and you buy the right amount of equipment from us, and we're fine. This has gone on, especially since General Mattis left the administration, and I think he was the only one who truly cared and who wanted to use U.S. influence to end the war. He tried. He took a firm stand a couple of months before he left. And we had the Sweden, the Stockholm Agreement as a result. But to my mind right now, what's going on is that the Hodeidah Agreement has been a sideshow for the Arab coalition mainly, because it's a good PR thing to try to achieve peace starting in Hodeidah. And Martin Griffiths is doing a great job, but it's limited to Hodeidah, especially that the battles are going on elsewhere in the country. So both sides say, okay, we're not going to fight in Hodeidah, but we are going to fight in the north and in the east and in the south east. Particularly in the north, where you see from along the Saudi Yemeni borders, the force led by Ali Mohsen Al-Ahmar, which was nurtured, trained, given all the support they needed in Saudi Arabia. And Ali Mohsen Al-Ahmar has been at the operations center in Riyadh all along. And they are making headway into Yemen from that angle. There are some fierce battles on and off that have been going on there. Further south to the east of Hajjah and to the east of Sana'a, battles have been going on as well. And then when you go to the east of Sada, southeast, the tribes in that area have been courted heavily by Saudi Arabia to rebel against Houthi control of the north, and there have been battles going on there as well. When you look at the picture, you don't have to be a military expert to know, but you know, I would be glad to have some military expertise jump in here, to see that what they are doing is trying to block off the Houthis completely from any from the north, obviously along the border, and they're not doing a good job there because the Houthis are and have been for practically since the beginning of the war inside Saudi territory along the northern border. But they block them off in the north, in the east, and in the west, and hopefully at some point, from the Arab coalition's point of view, they will march on Sana'a from the south as well. So blocking off the Houthis would isolate them, technically, since they have they can't use the airport, and if they can't use the sea, even for the small boats that smuggle in weapons every now and then, and by land they have no access to the south anymore, then they are strategically really locked in. I believe that is what the Arab Coalition's strategy is, and it has been rejuvenated recently, which tells me that they're not really interested in the peace process. What they're interested in is pushing this war to a military victory. If the Houthis decide to surrender before their forces reach Sana'a, then well and good. But if not, I think they have every intention of pushing through to a military victory, something which the Department of Defense here never thought was possible at the beginning of this war. Not sure currently if they have changed their thinking, but I think U.S. military thinking has been from the start, this war is not winnable for the Arab coalition without direct American intervention. And the recommendation from all the experts in the U.S. government has been this is not recommended, that the U.S. should not get directly involved in Yemen. Helping the Saudis and so on around the edges is fine, but don't send forces and get engaged in real battles. So this is where we are. I think at some point we're going to talk about solutions, and I think the joint resolution, the SJ-7, which was vetoed by the president, failed because, I mean, it still was a historic attempt on the part of Congress, but they didn't have enough numbers, they still don't, to override the veto. Because there are three complex things in it. The ending the Yemen war is one, but U.S.-Saudi relations is second, and the constitutional conflict over the War Powers Act, which involves arming and participating, even if indirectly, in the war in Yemen. These three are, each one is worthy of its own resolution, of its own thorough discussion and strategizing. But tactically, they couldn't just do Yemen alone because Mitch McConnell and the Senate refused to even bring it to a vote. Whereas when you insert the War Powers Act and arms sales, procedurally, he is forced to bring it to a vote. It was a catch-22. You couldn't run the end Yemen war alone. When you mixed it with other things, you could get a vote and get a majority behind you, but it complicates things for the hardline supporters of the administration. And here's where we are. I'm sure we'll get into discussion of it later.
Thank you. Thank you, Nabil. That's very insightful. And I hope we do drill down a little bit on the strategic situation, because that would inform all the diplomacy and the humanitarian efforts. And now we'll turn to Sama, who's promised us a look at the various dimensions of the conflict.
Thank you guys for being here this morning. I'm looking forward to explaining the Yemen situation, and I'm very excited to be sitting with this panel here. And I want to start by managing your expectations. So I was assigned to do the local dynamics in Yemen, and it's a very heavy topic. I could actually spend hours trying to explain what each region looks like, because the war has been going on for 4 years plus. We're in the fifth year. And as you can imagine, a lot of things that were true are no longer true. And some things I might say today will change tomorrow, and that is the fluid dynamic of the war. And so just to begin, the way that the war was designed was meant to kind of divide and create separate realities. And by that, if it was quick, it could have been quite a successful war. But the fact that the war took on 5 years meant that it helped feed divides and fragmentations that already existed in Yemen. I am so thankful that you guys prepared a map for today, because I'm going to talk about a general situation, and then I'm going to break it down into case studies and specific areas. And so, first of all, the population that is living under Houthi control is witnessing a war dynamic where they are controlled by the Houthis. That's one. Two, they're also living under airstrikes. And the first 2 years of war, that was really difficult because we didn't know whether the airstrikes were going to be very accurate. And the fact that indiscriminate airstrikes continued to occur really terrified a lot of the population, which I think heavily recruited for the Houthis. And I think that was a real problem from the start. The idea of indiscriminate airstrikes in the Houthi-controlled territory just really helped the Houthis move forward and gave them kind of the reason of being to keep and carry this war. And then on the other hand, you have what is called Houthi-free territory. However, it's not very clear whether the Yemeni government has complete control of that entire area. So instead of talking about proxies and, for example, mercenaries that are present in Yemen, we have Sudani mercenaries, we have, in some cases, it was reported even British and maybe even some American mercenaries on the ground. But instead of talking about that, I really want to discuss what is happening on the ground. And so as I'm discussing this, I want to plant a question in your mind. Will the conflict end with ceasefire, right? This is something to keep in mind as we talk about local divides, because I think it's far more complicated than that. And what happens typically in the war is while you de-escalate on one front, fights tend to pick up on another front. For example, while you de-escalate on the western coast of Yemen along the Tahama region, you notice that there was an escalation on the other, the eastern part of where the Houthis control. The last major fight that was extremely bloody was known as the Hajur Battle in Hajjah. So you have a dynamic that is completely fluid, and while de-escalation happens in some parts of Yemen, it doesn't happen throughout Yemen. It happens in some parts and heats up in other parts, and it continues to play this fluctuating game. So I am actually going to begin with the separatist movement in the south of Yemen. And the separatist movement is spread out throughout the south, and they have been organized now under the name of the Southern Transitional Council. The Southern Hirak movement existed in Yemen for many years under many names, and many factions existed under that umbrella on the premise that they all want secession but cannot agree on how to do it, who their leadership is, and how to achieve those goals. And what the war did is definitely increased that sentiment of separation. When the Houthis went down to Aden to try and capture President Hadi, as they claim, or to take over the country, whatever their motivation was, when they went to Aden, it definitely made them look as an invader in a southern territory, and it increased the sentiment of, we don't want these people here and we have to fight them out. And certainly it did not help that the government is playing a hot and cold game with the separatist movement. And by that, I mean that in 2012, when President Hadi was in government, he did not really acknowledge the separatist movement as much as he does today. He did not have any separatists in the government structure. When the Yemeni National Dialogue occurred in Sana'a, when it took place, the southern separatist seats were actually handpicked and selected by the president, and the majority of the separatist movement decided to say that they do not believe in the national dialogue, they do not want to be part of that process. However, in 2015, there was a strong shift in President Hadi's policies. For starters, a lot of his government and his cabinet was largely southern. And then slowly, as the war progressed, we saw that so in 2015, when the war started, his prime minister at the time was a southerner, and I think with him being removed from power, a lot of southerners either got fired or resigned. But certainly after that, we saw that the government appointed some very hardline southern separatists into the government. For example, the current head of the Southern Transitional Council, it used to be the governor of Aden, appointed by the government himself. The foreign minister of Yemen at some point was also a very hardline separatist who is no longer in power. But this is just to portray that, not just the governor of Aden, but also in Hadramaut and other places, but this is just to portray that the government was kind of playing hot and cold with the southerners. In a sense, they needed them, right, in order to capture the parts where the separatist movement had the most control. But at the same time, they didn't manage the process well. And so now we have a strong Southern Transitional Council and we have a strong separatist movement that is being heated in the south of Yemen. However, the media attention on it and the focus that's given to the Southern Transitional Council is claimed as UAE has labeled and framed the Southern Transitional Council as a UAE proxy. Right, it's not viewed as a legitimate movement that has occurred over the years, but rather as a hand and a tool that the Emiratis are using during the conflict. The same game that the government is playing with the Southern Separatist Movement is also played with other factions in Yemen, including Islah. But before I go into that, I do want to talk more about how the government is structured. It seems that the more that the war continues, the government is appointing people based on some sort of system of quotas where geographic representations are occurring in the government. So as of today, it seems that there's an increase from 2018 to 2019, an increase in northern representation in the government, which they didn't have at the very start of the war. And then also, there's a very strong Ta'izi voice in the government, in a sense kind of signaling to us that the focus of the government is going to shift towards Ta'iz next. And so as I speak about that, and I, again, this is how I started by managing your expectations, it might be a little jumpy as I move from one topic to the next. I would like to start my case studies at this point of looking at different parts in Yemen. We have Al-Mahara area, governorate, which is receiving a lot of American attention at the moment, mostly because Oman has been sending a lot of American experts to the area to kind of look at their peace settlement and what they're doing in order to move forward from the conflict. And it has brought a lot of people's attention to the region of Mahara, which is also in the geopolitical sphere of Oman. Oman has a lot in common with Al-Mahara. They even share a language in some parts of Oman and Al-Mahara. And Al-Mahara is an area that has not been impacted severely by the war due to its geographical location, and it's always been kind of autonomous in a sense. However, Saudi Arabia feels that they need to have presence in there, mostly to curb, what they're announcing is to curb smuggling, to stop human trafficking, and to reduce the smuggling of weapons to the Houthis. That is the proclaimed agenda. But what we also know is that in Al-Mahara's case, if Saudi Arabia successfully manages to create a pipeline to transfer their oil through Al-Mahara, it would certainly save them a lot of money, and it would divert Iranian focus away, and it would be a very secure and safe passage for them. And I think in that sense, if we look at the benefits of the war through that, then we can say, this war might be worth it to Saudi Arabia if they are able to achieve that pipeline, in the sense that would be a huge victory and relief for them. So it's interesting because the Saudi presence there has also come with development projects. 8 development projects have been announced in Al-Mahara alone. It's been very difficult for me to kind of verify what these projects look like or what's going to happen. However, the announcement is out there. And there's been some slight tension about the presence of the Saudis there, and the Emiratis, of course, tried to be involved, and the Omanis. And I would just say to keep an eye on Al-Mahara because it's a very important area for now. From there, I want to move to the area of Ta'iz that used to be talked about a lot. And then we have those waves of paying attention to Ta'iz and then not paying attention to Ta'iz and so on and so forth. Ta'iz continues to be one of the worst parts of Yemen's conflict. It hasn't been able to get the relief that some other parts of Yemen have received. It's, in essence, a complete chaotic situation. It's still very hot and unsettled. The Houthis are still besieging it somewhat on the periphery, and they have some territories there. We've mentioned at the start of the talk Abu al-Abbas militias that are in Ta'iz, and it seems that at the moment they're not doing very well. Their power has really decreased and looks like islands, you know, if Ta'iz was a body of water, it'd be scattered islands. And the problem with the Ta'iz war is, unlike the Aden situation where the Houthis were people who came from another part of the country and went right in, what you see in Ta'iz is the Houthis, I don't know how to describe it, but I'm going to use this word, the Houthiization of the population, which means that some natives of Taiz have taken up some of these doctrines and are fighting. And then on the other hand, you have the Yemeni government, the national army that is kind of functioning as an umbrella of different political parties. And those different political parties can't seem to agree with the government's perspective. So you have tensions kind of brewing within the military. Taiz is also, interestingly, the only part of the country where there is a large militarized presence of al-Nasirite parties and of the Yemeni Socialist Party, where they actually have some sort of stake. It's also kind of a mysterious case as to why they can't calm the tension there. Taiz now has its fourth governor in place since the war started. They all seem to be pretty qualified, actually, compared to other appointments throughout the country. But they still really struggle to maintain security or anything like that. And I'm sure that in Besma's talk, we can talk about the humanitarian situation specifically to Taiz, as there is only one route that can take you in and out of Taiz. And so while you can travel through the majority of Yemen at this point in a relatively short time, going in and out of Taiz remains to be a seven-hour debacle at sometimes, just to go from, let's say, the east part to the west side. And also, on top of it, just bear in mind as we talk about Taiz that it's actually one of the heaviest, one of the most densely populated parts of Yemen. I think the population is about 3 to 4 million. And so the fact that this is happening means it's affecting a lot of people. Now, on the flip side, I'm going to take you guys to Madib. And Madib has been portrayed as the ideal representation of, or a model state of what Yemen would look like once the conflict is over. And I think that it's interesting, and it certainly is not a model of what Yemen would look like once it's free, but they're definitely doing well. So Madib, for example, is revived due to the displacement of Yemenis from other parts of Yemen and going into Madib. So their population pretty much multiplied and could be estimated at about 1 million at the moment. You have symptoms of kind of economic renaissance of some sort. You have new buildings, new developments. And the fact that the people who control the region of Madib are the same group politically has helped them kind of maintain control in that area. And so there are many reasons why it is, in fact, stable, it is calm, it is economically revived. The reason it can't represent the rest of Yemen is mostly because it's a temporary situation. You know, the fact that they are doing better has a lot to do with how many people come in, how much funding they're getting from outside. But we also noticed that in Madib, there are some forced detainments, illegal detainments taking place. We know that Madib generally is a rich governorate because they have access to oil in that part of the country. And there's been reports and statements about how the people in Madib are taking the finances from the oil and are refusing to take it from their central bank and pump it into the larger national central bank for Yemen. And so the reason they're flourishing could also be attributed to the fact that they are wealthy at this moment. They don't have to share their wealth with everybody else. There's also, from what I was reading and following, some tensions with the tribes of Abida, who sometimes have to have things their way or kind of the highway. And so finally, I want to talk about a few things. I don't think I have time to talk about everything that I want, but I do want to look at what happened to Islah, the political party of Islah today. The political party of Islah was one of the strongest political parties in Yemen after the GPC, the General People's Congress. And what we're seeing is that the Salafi branch of the movement is very much alive, and not just alive, even divided in the liberated parts of Yemen. In the city of Aden, it manifests in tensions between Salafis who debate which school of Salafism is more accurate. In a sense, it's a manifestation of UAE versus Saudi tensions in the area. You also have the threat of Al-Qaeda in other parts, like Al-Bayda, for example, continues to be an area that the U.S. is very focused on carrying out operations there. And what we see in some places is that the Islamic State is fighting directly with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And then you also have the Muslim Brotherhood branch of the Islah Party that seems to be somewhat split. You have the Muslim Brotherhood of Qatar that has kind of taken off and split off from the war and is very active in the media. However, the vast majority of the Muslim Brotherhood is still allied with Saudi Arabia and is promising to carry out a lot of its acts. I think in the Houthi-controlled territory, the most significant opponent that the Houthis could have was probably the sleeper Islah cells throughout Sana'a that haven't really been active and haven't took up arms and haven't participated in the conflict. Perhaps they're waiting for this layer of the conflict to get settled or perhaps for the Houthis to get eliminated. And I think once that is removed, you will have another layer of conflict over power. To talk about the government, they are present throughout the country. However, alliances are not seemingly clear in the sense that some people are in the military to support their own political cause, or the tribe wanted them to do that, or even just directly for the sake of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I think the government is going to wage several internal battles that is going to make it very hard for them to continue. And a clear example of that is that recently the Yemeni parliament was kind of revived, and they were given an opportunity to host a session in Sayoun in Hadramaut. I have to say that the location is very strange because Aden has been the capital that they are operating from. That's the temporary capital. And that immediately signals that had they carried out this parliament meeting in Aden, the Southern Transitional Council could have interjected or interrupted it. And so they had to go to an area where security in Sayoun is still mostly run by military generals who are from the north. So they had to go to a place where they can't be interrupted by the Southern Transitional Council. It's also very clear that there were some protests on the Southern Separatist Front that were calmed down by the UAE, which means that if the UAE and Saudi Arabia are able to regroup and kind of realign their vision for Yemen, there's potentially a possibility for them to keep the South relatively calm. But mostly what's happening now is that the Houthis, you know, Dr. Nabil Khoury talked about how they're trying to choke the Houthis into a specific, you know, kind of circle and surround them from all sides. And I think that is a plan that could have probably worked in the past very well had the other sides fighting the Houthis been well aligned, organized, or did their work right. And so what's happening is that the war is poorly managed. There's no point at this point, after understanding all the local actors on the ground, there's no way to end this militarily without creating humanitarian devastation. And I think the more the mistakes occur on the other side, the more the Houthis look like victors and winners. And I think it's ultimately come time for everybody to sit at the table and talk about peace, because everything that I just mentioned signals that Yemen could be broken, not just to two countries, but to four or five, based on how the war has been carried out. And the longer it takes, the harder it is to go back to just operating under the umbrella of Sana'a as a capital or Aden as a capital that would serve the rest of the country.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Basma?
That's the good news.
The best news. I'm just trying to bring this closer. So thank you to the Jamestown Foundation for inviting me to be here, and I'm very honored to be on this panel alongside my fellow colleagues. So to start with, I wanted to present my talk with looking at the impact of what Sama and Dr. Nabil were highlighting on and how that conflict is really translated to impacting civilians. And I want to break up my talk into five different parts, so bear with me. I'm going to talk about some of the statistics and figures in Yemen. I want to highlight some of the drivers of the humanitarian crisis, talk about NRC Yemen very briefly, and then offer some reflections and conclude with an anecdote. So to start with, I'm sure most of you know, prior to the conflict, Yemen was considered one of the most underdeveloped, if not one of the most poorest countries in the Middle East. So that's the baseline that we're starting with. We were talking about extreme poverty levels where about 18.8% of the population was living under the poverty line. There was high infant mortality rates and child malnourishment was at 42%. So keep those in mind as we look at today. So today, the situation is, as you can imagine, a lot more dire. You're talking about 24 million civilians that are in need of some form of humanitarian assistance. Of those, there are those that are considered to be in acute need, which means they basically cannot survive without humanitarian assistance. And last year, that number of acute need was 11.3 million. In a span of 1 year, it increased to 14.3 million. So if we think, you know, the situation can't get worse in Yemen, over 365 days, we saw an increase of 3 million Yemenis becoming more reliant on humanitarian assistance. And that's huge. There's about 4.7 million children that are in need of some form of education assistance because they either can't access schools or they just don't have the resources to participate in schools. And the displacement numbers, right now, we're talking about 4.3 million Yemenis internally displaced. Compared to other crises like Syria, like, you know, Venezuela, these aren't massive numbers. But if you think about it, these are 4.3 million people that are essentially stuck within Yemen. Because of Sana'a Airport being closed, because of other coastal areas being inaccessible due to the multiple front lines, you're talking about civilians that are forced to flee internally, and we're seeing this circular pattern where people are fleeing from one area to another, trying to escape from different forms of violence. So it's this perpetual cycle of displacement that only contributes to their increased vulnerability and their increased risk. Now, I'm sure all of you have really heard about the food crisis in Yemen. That's usually how it's portrayed in the media. Just to highlight some things there, so access to information, to accurate information in Yemen is extremely challenging. And I think that contributes to us not seeing a famine declared. But I think given the situation and given the extreme needs across the country, in certain parts of across Yemen, it is safe to say that there is famine. And the problem with not announcing, or you might feel some relief in the fact that famine hasn't been officially declared, but that's actually, I think, a false optimism, because once famine is declared, that means it's already too late. That means we're talking about people that have died and that we have failed to respond to. So even though it hasn't been declared yet, means that we might have some bit, you know, some glimmers of hope where we can respond. But I think it's also realistic to assess that there are areas with famine and there are areas where people have actually died of starvation in 2019. So shifting over to the drivers of the humanitarian crisis, I think the first and foremost factor driving the humanitarian catastrophe is violence, and more particularly, the destruction of civilian infrastructure. And by that, I mean the attacks on hospitals, on civilian homes, on schools, on areas that are typically, you know, not to go into IHL, but like typically not areas that require additional protection. So just this week alone, we saw attacks on civilian homes in Saada through by heavy shelling and airstrikes, that killed 10 civilians. We're also seeing clashes and hostilities in Hodeida, despite the UN agreement that Dr. Nabil alluded to. We're seeing in Hodeida specifically attacks on homes, on farms, on local businesses, all attacks that contribute to the complete depletion and loss of livelihoods. So you're talking about people that are, you know, experiencing exacerbated vulnerabilities. You're seeing a lot of ongoing fighting in Al-Dala, where civilians are being targeted, but also because of the IEDs and explosive remnants of war, civilians are also falling casualties to exploding IEDs as well. Hajja has basically, the fighting in Hajja has forced over, you know, thousands of people to flee their homes. This week alone, we saw a water truck that was targeted by an airstrike. We saw a civilian vehicle that was targeted by an airstrike, which killed 7 members of the same family. Taz and Ib, fighting is obviously continuing, as highlighted by Sama. This week alone, again, we saw a shooting incident in Taz that killed 7 civilians. And in Ib, we saw an airstrike that fell on a school and a main road. So again, these, you know, civilian infrastructure, and more particularly civilian homes, tend to be the most impacted structures. The first quarter of 2019 alone, we saw 1,698 attacks on civilian homes. So violence is definitely the biggest contributor to the humanitarian crisis. Second, you have the inflation, high prices, and the economic decline across Yemen. So with the depreciation of the rial, with the conflict, you know, continuing to deplete people's access to resources, you know, the elimination of people's infrastructure and livelihood opportunities or assets, prices of food really soaring, all that coupled with just an inaccessibility of food. I think it's, in some areas in Yemen, it's safe to say that food is just completely inaccessible. It's not there. But then you're also talking about areas where food is plentiful and it's completely there, but it's just not attainable. It's at prices that are completely out of the reach of ordinary civilians. I was in Sana'a last year, and going into one of the major like hypermarket chains, I saw a cereal box for $8. I wouldn't pay $8 for cereal in the US, let alone in Sana'a. So it's things like that that obviously are contributing as well to the vulnerabilities. We're also seeing a third issue, and that's the closure of ports and some ports being just heavily congested. So like I mentioned, Sana'a Airport being closed, which means civilians can't flee conflict. They can't seek any areas outside of the country for safety. But that also means there are barely any medical evacuations. So if you have a condition that can't be treated in country, your options to leave to pursue medical facilities abroad is very limited. You're also, for students that can't access schools, that may have gotten a scholarship to go attend a school somewhere outside of the country, aren't able to leave as easily, because if you can't leave Sana'a through Sana'a Airport, that means the only accessible airport or the closest airport is Adan, which means you're going to be crossing various front lines, and the trip might be expensive in terms of, you know, cost, but also in terms of human costs too, because of you're putting yourself at danger multiple steps along the way. Hodeidah Airport, obviously there's a freezing effect because of the escalation in the violence last year. This year we're seeing a lot of ships being diverted away from Hodeidah to Aden because they were incurring a lot of insurance costs. They were kind of docked on the ports for long periods of time as they were going through security clearances, multiple rounds of security clearances by the UN mechanism, but also by the coalition. Aden ports are also heavily congested now because they had the traditional routed vessels, but now you're getting the additional vessels coming in from Hodeidah. So that has really bogged down the port and its ability to deliver and undock goods. But you're also talking about a lot of bureaucratic impediments in Aden due to corruption, due to like poor governance, a whole gamut of issues that we can get into. Going back to the Red Sea ports, there's the Ras Isa fuel terminal that has been closed for a few years now. It's the only fuel terminal in the country, which means fuel has been coming into the country at severely insufficient and inadequate numbers. Yemen is below sea level, so in order to pump any clean water, you need fuel. And in order to prevent communicable diseases like cholera, you need clean water. So with fuel being very scarce, civilians are barely able to access clean water and also just electricity, just normal basic things that we would require. But that's also, and the fuel that's actually being allowed in or that's actually coming through is being sold at incredibly high prices. So again, just completely unaffordable by local populations. One thing also to highlight on the ports and the congestion there is you're also seeing a lot of goods being rerouted. Some are, you know, going through Aden, so they're having to incur, you know, additional transportation costs, so more fuel to transport the goods. All of these additional costs are directly being transferred over to the consumer. So a cereal that costs $2 is now $8 because of all these other multiplying factors that are contributing to the high costs. Fourth driver of the humanitarian crisis is displacement. So like I highlighted, there were 4.3 million Yemenis displaced across the country. 83% of those are women and children. So the displacement, as you can imagine, just exposes them to additional risk and increases their vulnerability. My colleagues were speaking to a woman named Rana in Lahej. She was internally displaced from Taiz in an IDP camp or an internally displacement camp. And her main concern is that she was 8 months pregnant, she was 1 month away from giving birth, and had no idea where she can access midwives, where she can access nurses, or any specialists. So just to give you an idea, these are some of the dire concerns that civilians are having to kind of factor into their daily lives. Fifth driver of the conflict, of the humanitarian crisis, is the fact that salaries haven't been paid in over 2 years, some cases 3 years. And that really has just meant that for civilians to really cope with these new realities, they have had to sell whatever assets they've had. The first is usually the wife's jewelry. Then you're talking about selling furniture, maybe property if your property still exists or it's still standing. And then we're talking about incurring additional debt, so borrowing from family and friends, from maybe other warlords that are willing to give out, you know, loans. And third resort, third stage of that is you decrease the amount of food that you consume. So a lot of, while I was there, a lot of the people that we spoke to were saying that they went from your average 3 meals a day down to 2, down to 1. And now even the quality of these meals, you know, some people haven't seen or haven't had meat, whether it's beef, chicken, in over a year. Children are surviving on yogurt and bread. I heard a lot of incidents of people just surviving on yogurt and bread, buying a pound or a kilo of yogurt for them and their family, and then in typical Yemen hospitality, expanding it to include other family members that can't afford to purchase food as well. That, as you can imagine, just leads to malnourishment, mostly affecting children, making them much weaker to being impacted by communicable diseases, as that communicable diseases and cholera being the sixth driver of the humanitarian crisis. So it's treatable diseases, diseases that usually can be cured with either, you know, an IV or a couple pills. But again, because of the delivery of goods being really choked off, because the medicine hasn't been flowing as freely in the country because of the conflict, when medicine gets in, chances are it spoils quickly because of the long delays and the rerouting. But then also, if it does arrive and not expired, it's at really, really high costs, and people just can't afford it. And the other issue is, again, the non-payment of salaries means a lot of doctors and nurses no longer go to medical facilities because they aren't getting paid, and they need to feed their families as well. And with the airstrikes really targeting, and the violence in general, targeting a lot of hospitals and medical facilities, that has created a decrease in the number of available facilities for civilians. So now what civilians are having to grapple with, in addition to the high costs and all of that, is that a lot of medical facilities are just really far from where they live. So they are often confronted with either choosing to forgo a day's work and that income that they will earn in order to save maybe one of their family members out of 7. So a lot of families are really confronted with these difficult choices that sometimes forces them to take dangerous decisions that can impact their ill family member. Right now, we're seeing 236,550 cases of cholera so far in 2019. That's about 3 times higher than we saw last year. And a quarter of those are really impacting children under 5. So NRC has been in Yemen since 2012. We work in about 7 governorates across the country, mostly on the west side. Our work, to be very frank, is barely a drop in the ocean. I mean, when you're talking about 24 million people in need, there is no way that 100 and plus INGOs in Yemen are going to be able to provide enough to sustain those needs. I mean, WFP is providing, is feeding about 12 million people every month. That's about half of the people in need. But nonetheless, we're trying. And NRC's four sectors specifically, we focus on education, where we sometimes try to rehabilitate schools. We provide education resources like desks, like books, other material. We also provide training for teachers that would like to get into the education field. We also do water sanitation and shelter, where we help families get access to clean water and hygiene kits to try to stem the spread of communicable diseases. But we also try to provide them with safe shelter during displacement. We also provide food assistance so that families can access food for those that can't afford to buy it, but also clean cooking supplies, because a lot of the cooking supplies are contaminated. A lot of families are actually using plastic and heating food in plastic on open fires. So you can just imagine the toxicity that they're intaking. Our last sector is what we call our information counseling and legal assistance, where we help displaced Yemenis get access to civil documentation like birth certificates, marriage certificates, death certificates, things that are extremely necessary to be able to get legal protection, but also birth certificates for children so that they can access public schools. Civil documentations allow families to access whatever's left of the public medical facilities so they don't have to turn to private facilities that cost, you know, a lot of money that they just can't afford. Now, as I mentioned, I was in Yemen a year ago, and I really went to try to understand the impact of the conflict on civilians and really learn how civilians were actually surviving throughout this conflict. We're hearing of these crazy numbers, but how are people actually being able to survive? And what I really saw is, I think, common in Middle Eastern culture, where a lot of families really relying on extended family support, either through remittances or other forms. I saw a lot of families really relying on the one or two breadwinners. You know, I met with one of the a college professor or a former college professor, has his PhD, but because of the conflict, hasn't been paid in the university, so has become a construction worker because that's the only way he can provide for his family. We're also seeing families turn to more dangerous mechanisms to try to survive, like sex work, like child labor, child recruitment. And all in all, I think however the dire situation was last year, it is much, much worse right now. A lot of families' resilience is completely eroded. We're seeing a generation that's completely lost because they were out of school for multiple years. There is a complete reversal in some of the social gains that were made in Yemen pre-2015. Some of the more conservative protection practices like early marriage, that has tripled since 2017. You're seeing, again, a lot of families taking their kids out of school, or if the kids don't access school, are putting them in the labor force, trying to, you know, do some daily work to provide, supplement the loss of income for a family. And you're also seeing a more entrenched tribalism, nativism, even though these identities really existed in Yemen prior to the conflict, but now you're just seeing it a lot more entrenched as people are turning more into their in-group for protection, for safety, which is just really eroding some of the social fabric. And like Sama mentioned, I mean, that doesn't contribute to a unified Yemen. And just to conclude, I wanted to just share a story from when I was there last year. I finally got my travel permit from Sana'a to be able to visit a school that we were using as a cash distribution site in Beni Harith, right outside of the capital. And it's basically, as soon as you walk in, you see the children inside the classroom being taught. But then outside, you see all these displaced families that are there to collect, you know, their cash vouchers, or they're there to collect some form of assistance. And to be very frank, it was the first time I had seen how this conflict had really impacted people. It was extremely overwhelming. Seeing families and, you know, fathers and mothers pleading for assistance and whatever they can get from NGOs, but at the same time trying to maintain a semblance of dignity. That was a very difficult sight. But as I was just kind of standing in the corner, minding my own business, just trying to observe and take it all in, a group of women just kind of swarmed around me. And they knew I was with NRC, so they kind of sought me out for assistance. And I speak Arabic. I thought I can, you know, just get away. So I kind of get away with my Arabic. And I just kind of smiled at them. And I, in Arabic, directed them to my colleague who can better assist. And these two particular women instantly picked up on my Syrian accent and totally forgot the reason they were there. They forgot their struggles. They forgot everything that they were going through and completely switched to start praying and, you know, empathizing with the Syrians that were besieged at the time inside Syria. And as you can imagine, that was completely overwhelming for me. And as I was trying to grapple and control my emotions while I was there, I just completely lost it. So as, you know, without controlling it, my eyes are swelling, my tears are flowing, and these women in turn are also starting to tear up. And at that moment, it was so overpowering. Their compassion, their humanity was so much more powerful than everything that was going on in the country, than everything that they were going through, that, you know, if I can leave you with one single message, it's that humanity it's not lost in Yemen, but almost everything else is. I mean, innocent civilians continue to bear the brunt of this conflict, and they're the ones that are the most impacted. And a political solution is needed now more than ever. So just take that with you, because if we wait around and we just sit around for US policies, for, you know, coalition, for Ansarullah, for whoever to really get their act together, if the international community doesn't pressure them, then that means we're gambling with the lives of millions that have already lost everything. Thank you.
Thank you, Basma. Glenn, we have about 5 minutes for questions. About five before the break. So that's pretty intense and pretty complicated. I want to open to the floor for those questions, but I wanted to kind of articulate three takeaways that I had from the presentations. From Nabil's presentation, I was interested to learn that there is a fluidity in the strategic position. It's not kind of a World War I-like stalemate where the parties involved might naturally conclude that negotiations was the only course. If the Saudis do indeed have a strategy to isolate the Houthis, if they have resources to put towards that strategy, they could logically say this is not the time to settle. There's more to be gained by fighting. So if we appeal for a political settlement, I think we also have to take into consideration the calculation of the players and the attractiveness of that settlement. Maybe future panels can delve into that. From Sama's presentation, I get the impression that we are on a one-way street, and the kind of changes that are taking place at the ground level in Yemen, the associations you're mentioning, the tribal loyalties that are being inspired, the kind of involvement and relationship either with Oman or the UAE, certainly Saudi, these are relationships that are likely to grow rather than diminish over time. So when we talk about outside influences being removed from Yemen, I kind of wonder if we're not likely to see more and more outside influences and less Yemeni nationalism, which of course puts in question the whole concept of a Yemeni state. And finally, from Basma's presentation, my takeaway is a deteriorating situation with very specific needs and challenges. And although I take your appeal for a political framework and a settlement in which to address these concerns, I just wonder if the world can afford to wait for that, given the prospects are so dim, and if there's not an imperative to start addressing some of the things you've mentioned ad hoc, even absent political progress, which seems to be elusive. And the question then comes, how do you start addressing some of these needs in this politically murky environment? And where could you make substantial, not fundamental corrections, but significant corrections to alleviate the current suffering? So that, for my purposes, some of the takeaways from a very, very rich presentation. Can I open the floor to any questions? Yes.
My question to the panel is this was excellent, very deep dive, very useful. The question deals with the division line between Saudi Arabia and UAE on use of the Ikhwan or Islah in Yemen. This seems to be an area where UAE and Saudi are not agreeing on, or are agreeing on, depending on which province. And I'm wondering if you have a response to that in terms of their ability to work together in the future of Yemen, given their differences on outlook on Islah and the Ikhwan. Thank you.
Islah, the party, and what was
Saudi Arabia, their relationship.
But disagreeing on what you said?
Sorry?
Ikhwan?
Yeah, the Muslim Brotherhood.
And Islah?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, who'd like to start with that?
So the UAE and Saudi public line, I doubt will ever acknowledge or admit that there is ever a divide, and the hope, and I think that's what the international community is trying to do. Certainly the United States position is to try to regroup and kind of bring them together for a clear trajectory in Yemen. I think that the problem with the Saudi-UAE alliance is not the Muslim Brotherhood, but rather the conflict over the Muslim Brotherhood in Yemen is a manifestation of a larger UAE and Saudi clash in vision, not about Yemen, but rather about their own economic development that's taken place. It seems that this is part of a larger historical narrative where the UAE and Saudi Arabia were not the natural allies that we see today, who are completely seeing eye to eye with everything. So for that to happen over a war that has certainly prolonged itself is something. But I think that the UAE has tried to publicly welcome the Muslim Brotherhood and try to speak with them. There have been a few reported meetings where they've met with prominent figures. But I think the issue with the UAE and Saudi Arabia is not particularly Islah, but rather the Yemeni government's ability to carry out duties on the ground. It almost looks as if the current tension is certainly between the UAE finding local partners on the ground in Yemen who can secure regions and areas. And it seems that the Emiratis, for some reason, have not felt that they can completely trust or rely on the Yemeni government for that, and have kind of bypassed them to create their own lines. And to touch on that, you mentioned something about the collapse of the Yemeni national identity, which is something that I, as a person who was born in Yemen, certainly feel, that Yemenis, as a product of this war, have forgotten their national identity and in a sense have adopted micro identities that can serve them and protect them during the current conflict. And as this conflict kind of carries out, It shows that there is no real commitment for peace from any side. If somebody was able to win the war, they would have already done so. And I think that at this point, what we have is an economy that is very functioning, an economy that is really serving warlords, the Houthis, and some members of the Yemeni government who are invested in continuing this conflict. That's really who's benefiting from the conflict. And to echo what Besma said earlier, I think her encounter with those Yemeni women is definitely the voice of the majority of Yemenis who are fed up and suffocated with the war and looking for any kind of relief. And so if relief means that I ally myself with a foreign identity that is going to give me dignity, that is going to provide me with power, that is going to give me peace, then I might do that.
Yeah, very quickly, I think it's an excellent question, because one of the puzzling things in the strategic sense is, how come with all these forces, all these numbers, all the technology, all the assistance they have from the U.S., from Britain, what's holding them up? What's holding them up is their divisiveness. And the fact that politically, and UAE doesn't admit to what its real goals are, although one can guess, following the line of their influence and presence. politically, they have divergent goals, Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And militarily, their front is very divided, so that the force that I talked about in the north coming in from Saudi Arabia is under Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar. It is that part of the army which he controlled before the war, the 1st Armored Division. Whereas in the south, at the Hudaydah front, it is one of the nephews of Ali Abdullah Saleh, along with his son, who operates from a distance from the UAE, and that's the old Republican Guard and the Palace Guard, separate forces that never really work together very well. They certainly don't work together well now, because there have been so many problems between them. And then the UAE has some troops inside Yemen, not that many. Saudi Arabia does not. There's 3, 4, 5 mercenary forces that doesn't gel well, either politically or militarily. And so there's a lot of military effort, but when you consider that the Houthis, are their strength is in their unity. They're fighting on 5 different fronts, and they're holding off all these different attackers. So I think that's the main thing, is you put your finger on it.
Basma, did you want to? Okay. Glenn, do you want us to take our break, or? Okay.
Is there any side in this conflict that seems to? Is there any side in this? Oh, name is Dave Onspach, unaffiliated. Is there any side in this conflict that seems to be more into respecting human rights of the citizens, or is it just one, you know, theocratic, autocratic faction fighting another autocratic faction? It seems, you know, are there any? In the, for example, conflict with Houthi versus Hadi or whatever, is there any side that's more into the human rights than the other side, or are they, you know, both equal?
Basma, you want to respond to that?
I mean, just from what we're seeing, and you know, my colleagues responding on the ground, there seems to be complete disregard for international humanitarian law, human rights, anything that preserves any, you know, dignity for any civilians or any protection. So from what we are seeing, I can't point to any party that's making any concerted effort to try to maintain or respect any of those international laws.
Absolutely. I think there are no clean hands right now inside Yemen. Everybody is committing war crimes. That's what the UN found. That's what the international NGOs have found. So as far as that's concerned, it's hopeless. I think the hope comes from outside. Well, inside, the civilians and their humanity towards one another, as Basma pointed out, it's a hope for the survival and the endurance of the population. But then the Yemenis in the diaspora, the Yemeni communities here in the U.S. and in Europe, there's a new generation of Yemeni men and women who are working in humanitarian organizations, think tanks, civil society organizations. They're doing terrific work. One problem is that they tend to be a bit politicized, and sometimes they fight their own wars on Twitter. I wish that they, like Sama said, they focus on their national identity and not on their fractiousness. When the war ends, this is where the hope will lie in rebuilding Yemen.
Last question.
Michael Ryan, Jamestown Foundation. I have a naive question, but it goes back to, I think, Nabil's point about strategy. You know, there should be some goal. And this was such a great panel, and it really affected my thinking a lot. But if you would ask me what would be your strategic goal for Yemen, it would be about humanity, about people, you know. And that changes everything you do if you can set that goal. But that may be a naive goal, it may be unachievable. But you know, if you say national unity, that's a different one. If you say the Saudi or the, you know, in other words, there's a lot of ways to line this up. I'm just not just asking Nabil, but what would be the goal, the prime goal that you would seek for Yemen, and what would be the two or three things you could do to achieve to break that down into parts so you could achieve it?
I like this question very much because I think Sama's presentation particularly was kind of a reality check. When you look at what's actually going on and then you calculate the likelihood for U-turns in what's going on, which is very slight, we're much more likely to see a continuation and an institutionalization, a gradual solidifying of evolving relationships. So I think, Michael, you're very incisive in questioning kind of the classic political notions of what success are, some kind of Dayton Accord, for example, and instead refocusing on along the lines of Basima's concerns, how can the situation be nudged? How can most egregious violations be sanctioned effectively? How can individuals and families in Yemen, a space be created for them so that they can live some kind of decent life? And I think thinking hard about these questions is a challenge to the panels that are to come. Anyone else want to come?
Yeah, I mean, I think the U.S. has the largest key to this conflict. Many people inside do. But the U.S. can end this war. The problem is it needs to realize, putting aside, I mean, the goal should be salvaging Yemen, saving Yemen, and preparing it for a stable, democratic, prosperous future. The humanitarian thing, I mean, forget it with this administration. I don't think you can hammer at the door till the cows come home with what's happening to Yemen on a humanitarian level. They won't care. The thing is that there should be a realization that it is in the U.S. national security interest to stop this war and to help Yemen stand back on its own feet and be a stable, prosperous country. Again, I don't think there is much hope in this administration because there is zero strategic thinking other than zero humanitarian interest.
Two final comments. Sena?
So the line of this conflict is to restore the Yemeni government to Yemen, the legitimate Yemeni government to Yemen, and then two is to ward off the Iranian threat in Yemen. A lot of what I struggled with when I'm trying to understand the conflict is how do you measure the Iranian threat being reduced in Yemen? and that measurement or that expectation hasn't been really communicated, right? Has the Yemeni government been able to return to Aden? The prime minister now resides there, but the Yemeni president has resided out of Riyadh for the past 5 years now. So how do we measure the success and the failures of the war? It hasn't been really communicated. But on the subject of the U.S., it's not just the U.S. that can create an impact in Yemen. It's the U.K., it's France, it's your traditional powerful actors. And that leads us to the quintessential humanitarian question of how do we make peace more profitable than war, right? Like, how do we convince a lot of these countries that are selling arms that are also the only actors who can really stand up to what's going on in Yemen because of the humanitarian situation? How do we convince them to switch sides and to just finally add on everything else that we talked about? I think every single day that the conflict continues, the more sectarian the narrative becomes and the more of a reality that that has become. A lot of the violent fights between the Houthis and their opponents tend to be of a sectarian jihadi narrative. And it seems that the longer the war continues, and to touch on the very first question, is it an autocratic or kind of theocratic? I would say both sides are operating on religious premises. And a lot of the war is being told to as just and righteous based on religious doctrine. And that's really risky because even when peace occurs, that ideology resonates and that right to power continues to exist within people's minds. And as sad as that is of a note for me to end on, it is definitely a reality that people in the U.S. need to be very aware of, that even if the war continues, there are all these products of conflict that can manifest and become hurdles in Yemen's path towards towards peace, whether 2 years from now or even 10 years from now, if it's not resolved correctly, if it's not resolved immediately, and if national reconciliation is not taken seriously. I think the conflict today is actually a manifestation of all of Yemen's conflicts and the failure to reconcile the Yemeni population after these conflicts. They're all manifesting now.
Basma, the last word.
So just a couple points from my end, piggybacking off of what Sema said. A lot of these conflicts in the Middle East didn't start as sectarian conflicts, but have spiraled into becoming. So if we can look at Iraq or Syria as any form of example, or any, if we can foresee from these conflicts what Yemen could become like, I mean, we have two very clear examples that we should learn from at least. But I think that really goes back to U.S. strategy and Western strategy towards the region in general, looking at it more through the security lens of whether it's drones or countering terrorism. And I think it's, you know, these conflicts post 2011, and just the spiraling and the consequences of these uprisings and what they've evolved to, it's time that the U.S. really takes another look at its strategy towards the region and really moves away from the security focus, the military focus, to looking more at a human rights approach. Again, that might sound naive, but everything else we've done hasn't worked. It's maybe time to reassess. I mean, just on your goal, I think the very immediate goal right now towards Yemen in terms of U.S. strategy should be looking at the humanitarian crisis and finding an end to it. I think that is the first immediate goal that all parties should take, and anyone with any leverage or pressure should exert. And just lastly, wanted to highlight the UNDP report that was released yesterday. As of today, if the conflict were to end today in Yemen, the country is already set back 20 years. And they have mapped out three different timelines of whether the conflict ends in 2019, 2022, and 2030. And all of that, if it ends in 2030, the country is set back over four decades. So, I mean, these are serious consequences that everyone should be looking at, everyone should be paying attention to. So I highly encourage everyone to check out that report.
We will leave it to the panels, the other panels.